Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's a pleasure to welcome you to this panel, which will focus on the presidential primary and caucus system. And it's a system that has been brought into, I think, sharp focus, of course, by the race that's going on right now. Let me just begin by saying that as a scholar of constitutional law, the last time I checked, the Constitution of the United States doesn't provide for any such system. It doesn't contemplate even the notion of political parties. It's nowhere mentioned in the Constitution. But at least for the last 40 years, we have had a system in which the presidential primaries and caucuses have figured large in the choosing of the candidates for the presidency. And so today we're going to take a look at that process through a variety of different lenses and criteria. For example, we have seen this year the issues that relate to the front-loading and the compression of the states trying to get ahead of one another in that system. We've seen concerns about the representativeness of that system at a number of levels, both with respect to whether the early states are truly representative of the rest of the country, whether the specific processes within states are really representative of the votes and the will of the people in those states. Also, whether or not the aggregate picture of the entire process is truly representative of something that we might think of as the will of the voters. So on all those criteria, we will be interested in examining the current system. And we should ask at the end of the day also, does this system work in terms of picking who we think of as the best vetted, best qualified, best candidates by whatever measure you think of as defining best? If there's time, hopefully we will talk about some possible reforms to the system. There's been so many different variants of reform that have been batted around in recent years, all the way from having a national primary system decided all on a single day to various regional types of rotating systems that we might explore. To do this, we have an outstanding panel to help us at least set the stage and begin wading through these issues. Let me introduce them from the far side of the table coming back this way. First of all, to my far left is John Zeller. He's a professor of political science right here, at UCLA. He's written a lot of books about political messaging and public opinion, and he's used simulation models to explore the advantage of incumbency. And he teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in American politics, public opinion, and statistical methods. And he's served for 8 years on the Board of Overseers of the National Election Studies. And he's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. Sitting next to John Zeller is Byron York, who's White House correspondent for National Review. He writes on a lot of issues related to the presidential campaign, judicial nominations, war on terror, the anti-war movement, and a variety of other subjects. He's author of a 2005 book called The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, which examines the role that the newly energized left, exemplified by such things as MoveOn.org, the Center for American Progress, and others, has played in the 2004 presidential campaign. Sitting next to Mr. York is Ken Kachigian. He's a senior partner in the Orange County office of Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck, with 30 years of strategic expertise in governmental affairs, complex business litigation, and public service. He served in the Nixon White House and later as special consultant to President Reagan. He was a speechwriter and a senior White House advisor in that administration. And he was also a key advisor and strategist for President George H.W. Bush's successful 1988 election campaign. And he's also served as an advisor and consultant to a variety of other elected officials, including George Dukmejian, Pete Wilson, Dan Lundgren, and Supreme Court Justice in California, Ming Chin. Most recently, he has been an advisor to Senator Fred Thompson in the 2008 race. And last but not least is my dean, Chris Edley, who came to Bolt in 2004 from Harvard Law School. Chris has a long history in civil rights law and administrative law. He has also served in a number of presidential administrations, including the Carter administration, Clinton I and Clinton II administrations, and most recently and continuing, he's been an advisor to the Barack Obama campaign. So with those introductions, let me just begin with initial comments from the panel members. They'll run about 10 or 15 minutes, and then perhaps I'll pose a few questions, but really would like to hear the questions that you all have. So be thinking about those as the panelists speak. So let me begin with Ken Kechigian to provide, first of all, a little bit of historical overview about how we got to the system that we currently have today, and then some additional comments evaluating that system. Thank you.
Dean Edley, I just want you to know I was accepted at Bolt some 42 years ago, chose to go to Columbia, which is why I'm probably here today, but came back to Bolt, and a great dean, later Dean Jesse Choper, helped get me through the bar exam. So I'm still grateful to Bolt for being a lawyer. A little history, I guess, about what we're doing here today is that fundamentally, I guess since I'm the oldest one here, is in 1968, there was great turmoil in the Democratic Party, and Hubert Humphrey, who actually never won a primary in 1968, became the party's nominee after a great tumult at the Chicago convention, where there was demonstrations and rioting in the streets, and according to a lot of people, a police riot. And after Humphrey lost, I think a lot of the party activists, especially on the left, felt that what was to blame was the process and not the candidate, or the process that created the candidate who lost. So after the 68 campaign, they formed the Fred Harris, then the chairman of the Democratic Party, formed the McGovern-Fraser Commission with George McGovern and then Congressman Don Fraser of Minnesota to write the reform rules for the party, and which attempted to pick up on the diversity of the members of the Democratic Party, created categories of delegates and whatnot. So it took the process, as they say, out of the smoke-filled rooms and into the era of reform, where now you have proportional representations, you have certain categories of delegates that have to be met. So that's how the Democratic Party progressed. Of course, for George McGovern, who was one of the members, chairman of the commission, it was a great boon because in 1971 and 72, he knew the rules better than anyone else. And for those of you who want to study this history, there's a couple of people, Gary Hart and Rick Stearns, who was the master delegate hunter, and Patrick Cadell, who was the wunderkind, one of the wunderkind pollsters in those days. So it ended up with George McGovern winning the nomination. So that's a little history. I hope that helps. I want to begin before my remarks about these reforms is the great irony of the 2008 campaign. And I hope this hasn't been repeated. I didn't come to the other sessions. But the great irony of this campaign is here California went on and on back a year and a half ago about how we never have any influence on who's going to be president, and we've got to have an early primary so we can have an influence in the process. And so what did they do? They moved the primary up to February 5th, along with 21 other states. And can you imagine now if the California primary was going to be in June of this year with some 400-plus delegates, 11% of the well, actually, more than that of the necessary count to win the nomination. And California this year would have had a huge influence in the process. And so just to digress a little bit, I am argue to my friends in the journalism community that California's always had influence because this so-called money primary they have is critical to candidates getting early money to help them in the other states. So we should not get California's always had influence. But this year it would have had even more. In any event, basically then what this panel is about, I think, is what hath the McGovern-Fraser Commission wrought. And My premise would be today that, and where I'd be doing an academic paper on this, would be that the delegate selection process and this reform commission process really may not have had that much influence on the direction of who the the Democratic Party has selected over the years as their nominee. I looked a little bit at the history of this. If you look at the old system of picking candidates, Stevenson, some were weak, some were strong. Stevenson was in 56, is running the second time against Eisenhower, was not a strong candidate. He was sort of a sacrificial lamb, I would say. But then the old system picked some strong candidates, like Jack Kennedy in 1960. And despite the outcome of the race, I would say that Hubert Humphrey was a strong candidate, and having been a young aide in that campaign and watching Humphrey pull from 16 points behind to almost victory, I would say that he was a strong candidate because he was a great stump campaigner, and he brought that campaign back. Of course, he had a lot of help from LBJ and stopping the bombing in 5 days before the election, but still, Humphrey was a very strong candidate. Then after the reform, it turned out that it helped the Democratic Party produce a lot of weak candidates. You had a weak candidate in 72, McGovern, who was benefited from all these reforms. You had a arguably weak candidate, and no offense, but a very weak president in 1976 in Jimmy Carter. And actually, Carter was not that good of a candidate, and Ford came from behind, and had it not been for a list of circumstances with the pardon of Nixon and the fact that Ford was an appointed president, Carter would never have survived against a strong candidate. Created a weak candidate in 1988 in Mike Dukakis. In 92, a strong candidate, in Al Gore, and a mixed candidate in 04. So I would say that my premise is that it's not the delegate selection process so much that influences the capability of the presidential candidate or who they pick. I still think that what influences the process more than anything else is a mixture of message, media, and political insiders. They still dominate. And even with the reforms, these factors have had influences on the outcome of the nominating process. So, for example, a combination of message, media, and political insiders took out Ted Kennedy, basically as a candidate in 1980, took out Joe Biden in 88, it took out Gary Hart in 88, Jerry Brown in 92, who was relatively strong but made some really stupid public comments, and it took him out. It hurt Dole in 88 against Bush, and certainly hurt Howard Dean in 2004. And then it also helped make strong candidates, and of course, Dean gets on both sides. He was made by the combination of media, message, and insiders, and he lost by a combination thereof. And McCain certainly would fit in that category on the Republican side, and certainly this year, Huckabee, who benefited enormously from the early debates because he excelled in them. So I think that the process is still, by and large, less determined by this delegate reform process that began in 1972, and more by the traditional elements which influence campaign. At the end of the day, I think it's still the cut and thrust, the day-to-day of political campaigns that end up. If you have a strong candidate with a strong message who has, frankly, a little bit of luck in the end, where I think McCain did this year, you'll get the nomination. And to some degree, the same with Obama, assuming he gets there. So I'll conclude by saying that if there's any institutional change, it's my hobby horse of the stupid, insane Iowa caucuses, which don't make any sense by any Democratic small-d standard, in my judgment. If there's going to have an election, just have an election, the caucuses, I think, distort the system dramatically. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Byron?
I come at this from a reporter. I've never worked for a political campaign or candidate or office holder. So I come to this completely from a journalist perspective, although I realized a few weeks ago that I am in one way exactly like the top leadership of the Hillary Clinton campaign, which is that I had no plan following Super Tuesday. I like the compression of the schedule a lot because I told my wife, I said, well, I'll be gone from New Year's to February 5th, and then it's all over. Well, come home, and everything will be great. So I have, I guess, a personal gripe with the democratic system. But what I think we're seeing here in this race as it exists today is the crack-up of these democratic reforms of the 70s under the pressure of the particular circumstances of 2008. And I want to talk about two different types. One is the reforms to the primary system, which involves the superdelegates and the proportional awarding of delegates. And the other is the campaign finance system. And both were... I don't know. One was a party reform from the Democrats, and the other was a system reform passed by the huge Democratic congressional majorities that existed in the 1970s. And first, the primary reforms, meaning the system of awarding delegates proportionally as opposed to winner-take-all, and then the whole system of superdelegates. I think they're cracking up, not because they were a particularly bad system, but because you have an extremely close race right now with enormous Democratic interest groups' overtones. No system really works really, really well when the race is incredibly close. I mean, who would have cared about the process in Florida if one candidate in 2000, if one candidate had won by 100,000 votes? But when it's close, all of the flaws are brought up into the sunlight. And I think in this case it's worse in the Democratic race because of this enormous emotional weight that big Democratic traditional constituency politics has brought to this. You've got the first woman who might be the nominee versus the first African-American who might be the nominee, and you have a close race between them. And the results are probably going to be more disappointing, I think, to the loser supporters than if it were one white man versus another white man. The reason being, white female Democrats have gone very, very strong for Hillary Clinton. Black Democrats are voting almost unanimously for Barack Obama, and I don't think they're going to be just unhappy when their candidate loses. I think some of them are going to be outraged and may feel that the loss just wasn't fair and square, and that their candidate was perhaps victimized because she was a woman or he was an African-American man. And I think when it happens, there could be a lot of blame placed on the superdelegate system, but I personally think while the superdelegates are a problem, the bigger problem is the abandonment of the winner-take-all system in favor of proportional delegate awards. I think it's made the Democratic presidential race kind of like the playground at a progressive school. I mean, nobody loses, everybody wins something, everybody gets picked for a team, and they all kind of feel good about themselves. But you don't get a winner. You don't get a quick winner. You don't even get a semi-quick winner. And I think that's what's happening in this process. And it keeps the party, I mean, the Democratic Party is in a completely different mindset today for where it should be for the November election. And I want to talk about the other reform I think that's cracked up completely is the campaign finance reform system. Just if you just look at these numbers, they are completely different from anything we've ever seen before. Barack Obama raises $40 million in March on top of the $55 million he raised in February. Most of it online. Average contribution, I think, is about $98. Hillary Clinton raises $20 million in March on top of the $35 million she raises in February. John McCain, on the other hand, raises $15 million in March on top of the $26 million. So he is way behind the totals for the campaign. Obama has raised $235 million, Clinton has raised $175 million, and McCain has raised $75 million. He is virtually nowhere. So given that enormous Democratic advantage, which was all gained fair and square with contributions limited by the laws, we are now seeing an erosion of what used to be a deep and principled commitment to the public financing of campaigns among some Democrats. In the past, Obama made noise about accepting public financing, which I think would be $84 million this year. But now he says that he has created a, quote, parallel public financing system with all of those internet donors, suggesting that he's really kind of created a public financing system on his own. And he will likely become the first candidate in a general election ever to opt out of this reformed system since its inception. Now, given the amounts of money that he's raised, I mean, he'd be insane not to. The advantage he will have over McCain is enormous, and indeed the other day McCain said that he would probably take the $84 million because he needs it while Obama doesn't need it. But the system, you know, as it was supposed to exist, just doesn't really work anymore. It does remind me, I had a conversation a few years ago with a man named Michael Vachon, who is George Soros's top political advisor. And it was in 2004, and Soros was spending enormous amounts of money, $30 million of his own money, to try to defeat George W. Bush. And Soros had never given before, had never given more than $100,000 to anybody. And so I asked Vachon, you know, why is he all of a sudden giving so much money? And Vachon said, look at the playing field. There's so much money on the other side. This is what was available. By this, he meant the 527s that Soros was giving all this money to. Today, you know, you would expect perhaps Soros to give money to John McCain to help level the playing field, but I don't think that's going to happen. Anyway, with our current situation, I think the dream of public financing and that sort of ideal is just dead. So the question is, will these dead and dying reforms have to be re-reformed? And with campaign finance, I think it would be good to see the whole thing thrown out. I mean, I think Obama's parallel public financing system is a pretty healthy development, and I don't see any problem with that, and would like to see it become the way things work. And if it were in effect this year and there weren't that federal money available, John McCain would be in a mess, but I think Republicans would probably come to his rescue. What I think is more likely to happen is that the system will just become irrelevant. Next time around, all the candidates will skip the whole primary system financing, which they did this year, and then they'll skip the general election financing too, and people won't check the thing on their tax reforms, and it'll just die. And as far as the reforms in the Democratic Party are concerned, I think that most of the problems that are the result of the close race today with all the emotions involved will certainly create a lot of calls for change. And I personally think winner-take-all would be the way to go. They can solve their problem that way. But if you leave the system pretty much as it is, and if Obama is elected, maybe he won't have that many problems with the system that he worked so well, it really probably won't be a huge problem unless you have another historically close race that pits two major Democratic constituencies against each other. So in spite of the fact that these systems have kind of cracked up, I think we might just see the whole thing pretty much left in place in the future campaigns, but just become less relevant, and all of the reforms will remain unreformed, and I guess we'll have something to talk about next time.
Thank you. Professor Zeller?
I always hate coming after reporters because they're funny, and I'm not, and he's kind of used to having to hold an audience, and I'm used to a captive audience, people who have, you know, they're grateful to be able to get into my course, and then they're nice to me, and so, but I'm going to try hard, and hopefully not completely blow it here. So I like the system. I don't think it's cracked up. I think it's working well. And it's working well according to the two global criteria that I think are important. It's been selecting pretty good candidates, or no bozos, for about 25 years now. And the voters are involved a lot, so it's pretty democratic. Those are big, important things, and it's important to keep track of them. Let me just go into a little bit more detail on the criteria, the no bozo voter involvement criteria that I have. Four criteria. First of all, you want a system that's going to produce candidates who are politically good, good representatives of their party followings, good on the stump, as Ken was saying, somebody who can give a speech, get out there and rouse the voters, but also somebody who is a good Democrat is going to be acceptable to the Democratic blocs or a good Republican acceptable to the Republican blocs. All of the candidates since 1980 nominees have been good in that way. As an example of candidates who are not good in that way, I had mentioned Mike Huckabee, fine man, you know, good from some points of view, but not a good man to unite the Republican Party and compete well in November, and he didn't get the nomination. A guy who was also not good and who did get the nomination was George McGovern. He was very pleasing to some Democratic groups, but not all. So there are some bozos out there in that sense, fine people, but not good representatives of their party who haven't been nominated since 1980. And that record is not going to be broken this time. A second criteria that I think is important is that the candidates have got to be temperamentally suitable. And by that I mean they've got to be comfortable with the give and take of Democratic politics, getting criticized, and not getting too upset about it. Candidates that I think were not temperamentally suitable, but who I can imagine becoming president of the United States in a broken system where being able to talk well and ride a wave was good, was helpful, would be Ross Perot and George Wallace. Both of them could have emerged from a free-for-all and maybe even gotten elected president of the United States. I don't think they were temperamentally suitable. And again, nothing against Ross Perot especially. He's a great American, fine man. If he has any relatives here, I like the guy and everything. But he just wasn't right, you know, temperamentally suited, in my opinion. Those of you who know him, maybe even especially if he's your uncle or something, but I suspect know what I'm talking about. Another way in which aspect of temperamental suitability is that the person must be responsible. Not a kind of a person to go off on an ideological tangent, to do what he or she thinks is right, regardless, to be wanting to please the public and in the short run, not do the right thing in history, but be responsive to the forces that are out there in the here and now. And again, that's not something that's to be taken for granted. We haven't had a problem with it. But in some states, they've had a problem with it. In Louisiana, they have an expression, elections is when we let the fat hogs, throw the fat hogs out and let the lean hogs in. And that stands for the idea that candidates, once they get into office, are played at their friends and their cronies and aren't concerned about good governance. So I'd say that a candidate who does that is liked by his friends, but not temperamentally suited to be the president of the United States. We've had none of those guys for maybe since Warren Harding, and none of them or even close to that in the current system. And I think that's important. Third criteria is we want voters to be involved. We want to have a lot, because this is a democracy, and we think that the voters have wisdom. But we don't want too much democracy. And I'm going to talk more about not too much democracy. But I don't think we have too much democracy. I think we have some very suitable limitations on it. Not as severe as the founding fathers put on our system of presidential selection, but nevertheless, some limitations on democracy. And I think they work pretty well to get us the first two things that I've mentioned, because we don't want a free-for-all system where somebody who's temperamentally unsuited or not a good representative of his party could rise to the top. My fourth criterion is we want opportunities for leadership, and we think of oftentimes leadership in our system as what presidents provide. Abraham Lincoln was a great president, was a great leader. Abraham Lincoln, I guess, he certainly was a good speechmaker. But what was important about Abraham Lincoln was that somebody credibly nominated him for president. A party nominated him for president, and that party came into existence. To make a long story short, because of abolitionists, people who hated slavery and wanted to provide leadership against it. They brought down the old party system, created a new party, and put Abraham Lincoln in office, whereupon a civil war occurred, and he dealt with that well. But a lot of the leadership was getting him in office, and that wasn't him. That was a movement of what I call I and some others, I'll mention in a second, call intense policy demanders, people who really want something really bad and form a movement to get it. And among the intense policy demanders who have been important in the history of our country are the Federalists, who brought us our country out of a mess, out of the mess that was the Articles of Confederation. The abolitionists, there was a progressive movement. There are now Greens, pro-life, pro-choice, pro-gay, intense policy demanders out there trying to lead our country in a direction that they think it should go. And presidential selection is the opportunity for them to select someone who will lead the country in that direction, the direction that they want, which, as I, from the groups that I mentioned there, and I could mention some other others, libertarians, gun owners, people who they have strong views about where they would like the country to go, and I think it's good that they should have an opportunity to have a say in selecting the president, even if it's a little bit undemocratic. As the abolition, you know, there wasn't the abolitionist movement that brought Abraham Lincoln to power, or the Federalist movement that brought us our country. That was not a mass movement. That was much more of an activist movement. And so some of those activists who want things that all the rest of us don't want at the time, nevertheless, do really good things for our country sometimes. And it's important to have a system that gives them an opening. And I think our system that we have gives them an opening. So my criteria, does a system do well or badly? Does it get good leaders? Does it have mass involvement? It has mass involvement, obviously. No bozos. I'm going to talk about how the opportunity... Oh, I should have... Sorry, losing my notes here. Opportunities for leadership. I'm Obama and Clinton right now, black and a woman. I'm not sure that either of them can win. Black or woman, it's not a plus, but it's testing the limits. It's trying to do something that some people think would be a good thing for our country. And the system, obviously, one of them is going to be the nominee. It's going to be... It's going to be a chance to try something new, and we'll see how it goes. So that's my evidence that the system is open to trying bold new things. Okay, so I say the system works well. Does it work very well? My moral antenna are not so refined, but it doesn't work badly. It doesn't produce George McGovern every time, which was I think was a transitional system from the pre-reform system. It worked badly. But I think it works well. So I want to talk a little bit about why it works well. It seems unlikely that this could all be happening by accident. I think you need to have somebody behind the scenes doing some sort of intelligent action, and there is. The name for it is party, political party. It takes its major activity is shaping the candidate fields. Mostly before the voters get involved in what's sometimes called the invisible primary, before the regular primaries. It's not the superdelegates. People are equating parties with superdelegates. Parties do their best work in smoke-filled rooms behind the scenes. And the superdelegates are going to be forced now to make a decision maybe in the open. Parties don't like to do that. Parties are these groups of intense policy demanders who are not always extremely popular with the whole country, like abolitionists weren't, like Greens aren't universally popular, like pro-life, pro-choice are not universally popular, and so on. Parties do their best work behind the scenes. So superdelegates are not parties doing their work. Where parties do their work in this system is, as I say, in the invisible primary. That's about the year or two or three before the regular primaries occur, when the candidates are going around speaking in boring candidate forums and trying to generate excitement for themselves. In most of the races since 1980, somebody has emerged as the favorite of his or her party in that period and gone on to be nominated. George W. Bush, definitely. Al Gore, Bob Dole, back to Ronald Reagan. All of these people emerged as commanding favorites in the invisible primary, and voters in their respective primaries took the cue of something that they didn't really understand very well, but that was happening in the invisible primary. They took that cue and went ahead and voted for them over some people who were oftentimes pretty good candidates, like George W. Bush beat John McCain. George W. Bush definitely was the insider favorite. I say that based on some research, which I'm going to, this is like I'm not puffing myself. I'm just saying that I'm not saying this off of the top of my head. That's the point of what I'm about to say. I've just been involved in a book project with Marty Cohen, David Carroll, Hans Noel, and me. It's called The Party Decides. And we gathered quite a bit of evidence, and David talked about it yesterday, about how the invisible primary works, how endorsements are made during the invisible primary, which do not follow the polls but lead the polls and shape the polls. And that's what happens in the invisible primary, and it happens. And it creates a kind of a cue to voters, which voters in the primaries normally take. And so George W. Bush had that cue in 2000. He beat a pretty strong candidate. And that's been the tendency in most of the races from 1980 to 2000. It's not been working so well in 2004, 2008, which I'll talk about, but it hasn't been disastrous. So party, what is a, I want to say a little bit about what a party is. I said it's not the superdelegates. A party is a coalition of, we argue in our book, intense policy demanders, which are some kind of traditional interest groups like the Chamber of Commerce or civil rights organizations, but also just activists, ideological activists of the left or right, gun owners, Greens, people like that, have formed coalitions so that, say, three big groups in the Republican Party are, say, business conservatives, religious conservatives, and gun owners. On the Democratic side, you might say civil rights people of various kinds, gays, women, blacks, unions, Greens. So those are two different groups of intense policy demanders, and they work in coalition. Their leaders and their active members work in coalitions behind the scenes to nominate someone who will be, within each party, acceptable to all of them. And acceptable to all of them is important. If one of the major groups dissents, as the religious right may dissent from John McCain, if it seriously dissented from John McCain, it would be very bad for John McCain and the Republican Party. Now, they may come around, but it's very important that they be that the nominees be acceptable to all of them. Why? These are groups who want something out of politics. They try to form a deal among themselves to max out what they can all get out of politics by who they're going to nominate. And this is what I, in another way, I would call leadership. So let me describe how that would work for, say, George W. Bush in 2000. George W. Bush in 2000 had something that none of the Republican candidates have this time, which is the united support of business conservatives and religious conservatives. And as part of getting that support, he made an implicit deal that he was going to, I'm going to now focus on Supreme Court nominations, was going to nominate somebody who was acceptable to both of those groups, and in particular the religious conservatives. He made that implicit promise. It's pretty clear in the 2000 campaign. He didn't make it publicly. In fact, he said no litmus tests. But he made it privately, and he came through on it. And the result of that is that we have two Supreme Court justices now, Alito, and Thomas, who are going to attempt from the Supreme Court bench to provide leadership in a pro-life direction. And we'll see how it goes. You know, it may result in significant change or it may not, but that, to me, is leadership. They're in a position to lead the country in a direction that some of the intense policy demanders in the Republican Party want, and that's good. They're going to get their chance. And the thing I want to emphasize about this, this was, I think, an implicit deal made in the invisible primary. It's why these groups are involved in politics. And that's what our parties do. Those groups try to get control of candidates at the nomination stage by selecting someone who will do what they want once they get into office, rather than trying to influence George Bush on Supreme Court nominations at the appointment stage, which is very difficult to do. It's very difficult to influence somebody as influential as the President of the United States. But you can maybe pick somebody who's going to either have promised to do what you want or want to do what you want. That's what parties are about. And I think that they're effectively doing that through the current process. What are the institutions by which they do that? Well, the undemocraticness of Iowa small turnout of very ideologically oriented people gives the party insiders disproportionate influence in that winnowing stage. It was very interesting what happened to Rudy Giuliani, who was not acceptable to religious conservatives, was leading in the polls, had more money than anybody but Romney, basically withdrew from Iowa because he couldn't get activist support on the ground in Iowa, and similarly in New Hampshire. So Iowa and New Hampshire, as they work now, are giving disproportionate influence to the activists of the two parties, of both parties. I could tell stories about the other party, too. And the slight undemocraticness of Iowa is helpful to party insiders. The winner-take-all feature of the Republican Party, slightly undemocratic, is useful for allowing somebody to emerge as a leader in a clean way. People are upset about it. It's only slightly undemocratic, and I think it strengthens the role of parties and party groups in the process in a good way. National primary, if we go to that instead of Iowa, instead of proportional representation, you'll still see intense policy demanders working in coalition within the two parties to send a cue that controls the outcome of a national primary. So I'm not sure that if we change the institution in that direction that it would completely destroy the kind of good party responsibility that I think we have. It might weaken it or it might throw it askew for a few elections, but they would be back. Whether it would work well or badly or better or worse than we have now, I'm not sure, but it would work at least a little bit. So our system is working well. I wouldn't rush to change it, but if you want to change it, that's okay, because I'm confident that that the parties would find a way to be influential in any system.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Excellent. Dean Edley.
Well, I agree with most of what's been said, so why don't I just not say anything?
That's not an option.
Okay, I tried. Look, I want to start with a disclaimer. I hate campaigns. I mean, I really, really hate political campaigns.
That's why you've been involved in so many.
Yeah, there's that problem, but. No, actually, I was counting up. I was marginally involved in 80 and 92. I was very substantially involved in 2000, 2004, and this year as a unpaid senior advisor. And I was involved in a senior role on a full-time basis in 76 and 88. But I hate campaigns. Chancellor Bourgeonneau came back from India a couple of weeks ago, and he said that in his 2 weeks in India, meeting with people from the prime minister to street vendors, there was intense interest in our nomination process, and particularly in the Democratic side, and especially around Barack Obama. And he said that there were two things that were amazing to them about it. First was Obama's middle name, and the second was the openness of it. They have obviously the world's largest democracy, and they have political parties, and they vote. But it's insiders who pick who appears on the ballot and who's going to be prime minister and so forth. And he said that the people feel somewhat distanced from that process. So from where they sat observing this intense popular participation in who was going to be the party standard bearer on both sides was completely fascinating and even inspiring. But I hate campaigns. I think on balance, I'm largely a defender of our current process as well. Let me start with Iowa. I understand Ken's perspective. I hear it from my wife all the time. She's working for Hillary. My experience in Iowa, however, I think is tilted strongly based on my experience there. I've been to about 85 of the 99 counties in Iowa. When I was working as National Issues Director in the Dukakis campaign. I found this caucus system and the retail politics that goes along with it just phenomenal, just phenomenal. My experience was that Iowa caucus goers are professional presidential candidate screeners, and they take it incredibly seriously. And as issues director for Dukakis, I had the experience of being in a panic every week before we sent Dukakis out to Iowa, because we knew that he would be in these living rooms and in these barns, and he was going to get cross-examined on everything from nuclear missile modernization to dairy prices and everything in between. And that the chief political reporter for the Des Moines Register, Dave Yepsen, was going to be in the back of the room waiting for him to slip up. C-SPAN was just becoming a force, and CNN, and increasingly their cameras were there also to catch it. So you had to be on your toes. And I saw over the period of months, everybody in that field, but particularly my candidate, become better and become trained at how to lead the nation, because it forced you to learn about so much and about so many different kinds of people. I mean, they're actually sort of cities in Iowa and several different industries, but you get asked about everything. Moreover, if you watched the caucus process on C-SPAN and you have this experience of seeing committed fellow citizens arguing with each other about where the country should go and who should lead it, I think it's pretty inspiring. And having a place for that kind of interaction in our process, I think, is to the good. Howard Dean, for whom both my wife and I served as senior advisors and were very early supporters, Howard Dean proved himself to be not ready because of the Iowa process. I think that they sniffed out somebody who was not ready for primetime, because Dean was terrific for a couple of quarters, but he plateaued, he stopped improving as a candidate, and the people in Iowa sensed that. So I'm sort of a defender, strike that. I am a strong defender of the Iowa process, to some extent the New Hampshire process as well, even with the drawbacks of not being representative, et cetera, et cetera. I'm less convinced that caucuses are useful later in the campaign schedule. In other words, after you've had that retail experience dealing with activists trying to persuade them that you're capable, repeating the caucus process in Texas, in Nevada, in Washington State, I'm much less confident about. Second point, finance. Well, look, $245 million raised from 1.3 million people, that's pretty cool. I also, in my campaign experience, have had this sense that, like working with the activists in the caucus process, trying to engage donors, particularly these low and modest dollar donors, is another form of campaigning. When you're trying to raise money in increments of $100 or even $2,300, it's not because you're trading favors. It's because you're doing an effective job of selling your candidacy and your ideas to a broad base of people, and people who are prepared to make the investment to learn what you stand for, make more of an investment than the typical voter who simply watches television, God help us, or perhaps reads a newspaper every now and then. So again, I don't think it's all bad. And to the extent that the internet has created this possibility for broad-based participation in the money primary, I think that is to the good. If you don't have the skill and the capacity as a candidate to raise a significant amount of money to make yourself viable, then you're not going to be a successful candidate. You're just not, and you're not going to be an effective president. So I frankly don't mind the fact that that there's this, that test of organizational capability and of marketing capability. Third, length of the season. God, it's gone on. I mean, it is just unbelievable. And as much as there was all this buzz about Patty Solis, Doyle stepping down as campaign manager for Hillary, the fact of the matter is she was flat out exhausted. And she's not alone. I have no idea how the candidates are doing it. They must be on drugs. But you didn't hear that from me. There was a time when Democrats argued to themselves that, you know, we can't decide too quickly. We can't rush to judgment. We can't just rubber stamp the party insider. We need more time to give candidates a chance to develop, to mature, to become familiar, et cetera. Well, I think that was right. I mean, you can have too much of a good thing, I suppose, but part of the motivation for this last round of calendar reforms, and my wife, who's a member of the DNC Executive Committee, was on the commission that did this last round of calendar reforms, was to strike that balance. Try to stretch out the decision-making process a little bit, but also try to put other states besides Iowa and New Hampshire into the very front, that pre-February 5th window. The point of adding South Carolina and Nevada was to make more diverse the set of folks who would have a first voice. Now, I think that was a step in the right direction, because it certainly let both Latinos and African Americans, let Southerners, let the West have much more of a voice in the way the campaign unfolded, the way the primary session unfolded. The length of the campaign has been an absolute boon to the party in a lot of purple states and red states. The folks in Nevada are ecstatic. The folks in Idaho are ecstatic. Barack was at an event just before the Idaho primary, the Saturday before the Idaho voting. I got a email from him shortly afterwards, after he was there. And he said he and his entourage walked into this room, 17,000 people, the only people of color in the room, so far as they could tell. And the governor told them that in the Idaho caucuses 4 years ago, statewide, a total of, I think it was 4,000 people participated. And they had 17,000 people at that one event. Now, Democrats are very unlikely to carry Idaho in November. But there will be Democrats down ballot for whom the energy that's been injected into the party will be dramatic. Will make a dramatic difference on their prospects in November. And I think that's all to the good and must be counted as an important plus for the extended season. The principal respect in which I think this is bad is that 6 months ago, had you asked me about our ability to heal the party, I would have said, no problem. It's just tension between the two principals and a small group of people immediately around them. But everybody else is just excited to have such fabulous candidates. I think as this has gone on and on, you're seeing more hardening within the party. And the risk of the kind of fracture that took place in 1980 or for that matter, 1968, increases. And I'm frankly very, very worried because I don't even know what prescriptions to offer Hillary and Barack with respect to how best to heal the party once the nomination is settled. Let me just wrap up by saying that while I agreed with everything that that Ken said, and certainly on the importance of message media and the insiders, I would not want to underestimate the importance of the personal qualities of the candidate himself or herself, and I'm sure Ken wouldn't either. These are extraordinary people who put themselves on the line to try to win this job. In a moment in history when our problems are as challenging as today, they're extraordinary, crazy people. You know, there has to be something special about you if you can look in the mirror every morning and say, I can do this. I can do this. I think that having worked in the White House in two administrations and seen very at close hand the pressures that face the president, you can't make a primary season too hard or too arduous because they're going to be tested in an incredible crucible. And if you don't know who you are and if you can't handle tough pressures, then you will be lost, and in turn, we will be lost.
Our time is about up. So one thing I want to say is that I wish we could bottle this panel and bring them back in about 6 months to see at the end of this process whether their predictions and their evaluations stacked up. Why don't you join me in thanking this august panel. Thank you for coming today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.